Hey there, this is Jenny Chen. I'm the founder of 3D Heels. Welcome to the Lattice podcast, the official podcast for 3D Heels. This is where you will find fun but in-depth conversations with technological game changers, creative minds, entrepreneurs, rule breakers, and more, focusing on how we can use 3D technologies like 3D printing and bioprinting to reinvent healthcare and even life sciences. This podcast will also include AMA, or Ask Me Anything sessions, past Instagram live interviews with influencers, and other direct engagements with our tribe. All right, so we're here.
Yeah.
Hey, everybody. Welcome, and thanks for joining us. And thank you for joining us, Stephanie. I want to give a little bit brief introduction of Professor Stephanie Willers. You're actually an acting chair for the biomedical research and biomedical engineering programs at University of Victoria. I also want to say that you're one of the youngest chair of such title. So congratulations. I looked into your bio a little bit, and it sounds like you're not really Canadian. You moved across basically from the eastern border of US, slowly migrating towards the West Coast, and eventually ended up in Victoria. So congratulations, you made it.
Yeah, I gotta say, I'm originally from Missouri. So I went east, then came back, and then I have to point that out because I just got an award from my alma mater, WashU, and they're very proud that like...
Right.
Good Missouri girl, doing good. now in Canada, so yeah.
Yeah, awesome. So, I mean, this kind of interview really is to introduce a rather serious subject like bioprinting, biofabrication, to in a little bit more casual way. But still, we want to talk about science. So the number one topic, I think everybody who's just joined us, is what is bioprinting or 3D bioprinting?
Oh yeah, for sure. And I do have like, as all good professors do, I have all my props here, but you know, everyone's probably on this Instagram is very familiar with all the traditional 3D printing, such as our little 3D printed axolotls, which is our company mascot. And so I think 3D bioprinting really sprung from that concept as 3D printing got more popular was when people began to modify. And I know Adam Feinberg at Carnegie Mellon, his group does this a lot, began to modify their 3D bioprinters to not just print, you know, plastics and things, but to actually try and print things like cells. And I think a lot of the original 3D bioprinters were homemade, and you see a lot of like the microfluidic influences there. So it's really sort of tuning these systems to be able to print tissues. And so to do that, you need specialized materials, things that are a bit more sensitive to the properties of the cells than just, you know, hard plastics. Also, another thing is when you work with living things like cells, you can't just melt things like you do with plastics. So you need to have printing conditions that were gentle enough to keep your cells alive as well as survive when you actually printed them into constructs. And so I think there's sort of been a couple generations of this. And then if you sort of look at the matrix of bioprinters, you have things that are on the higher end, like the Regen Hughes, Aspect Biosystems, those types of printers. And then there's things like the Levies. Some of the selling products are pretty affordable. So you sort of got this span of like homebrewed tissue printers for research use. And then there's sort of the higher resolution, more technical machines where they're looking for clinical applications. So it's been a really exciting time. And it's really been interesting just to see the technology evolve even in the last like half decade.
Yeah, what's really interesting is when 3D printing first came out, it didn't really create a machine solely for biology or bioprinting. And it really is the researchers themselves created a new tool on top of a new tool to generate this new field. So you mentioned some of the challenges in bioprinting. Would you like to just break it down to components of what are some of the day-to-day challenges you face of each of these components, from the cell to bioink to the machine to the software, and maybe even more that I don't know about?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's one of the things that actually makes 3D printing and 3D bioprinting really cool, is you have all these fields coming together. But as someone says, you know, like jack of all trades, master of none. Definitely each different component has its own issues. Depending on which bioprinter you use, like a lot of them have their own homemade CAD software. And I know it's driven some of my computational students a little bit crazy. Some of the processing that goes on with the G code, which I think some companies do that to try and get proprietary things, and some of the limitations for making more complex shapes, some of the software issues. A personal pet peeve of mine, and for anyone who's out there working on this, it would be great to predict if a bioink cell structure would be printable before you actually have to do it. We usually have to trial and error, usually with cheaper materials, cheaper inks, to see if a structure will print. Mm-hmm. So I know that Aspect has some AI people working on some of that. Printers themselves, even with traditional 3D printers, getting clogs, getting your throughput. Especially when you're working with some of the more viscous biomaterials and cells, you can get a lot of clogging and things. And I know my group, and probably lots of groups around the world, have done a lot of troubleshooting on how you actually get your systems to flow. And they do say when you get some of the printers working really well, you know, you can get up to 100 tissues in a day. So that's some of the machine challenges. Obviously, moving parts, lots of maintenance and things like that, depending on the system, control of pressure, control of fluids, things like that. On the inks, well, that's where our company comes in, but there's still a lot of work to be done on the material science side. A lot of the initial bioinks like alginate were selected specifically because they are very easy to print and to define structures, but they don't necessarily keep your cells alive or functioning, especially if you work with sensitive cells like stem cells. So that's something that's been very big and a big challenge in the field. And also if you look again at Adam Feinberg's work, he's, you know, the life support system, being able to actually print bigger structures and things like that, enabling tools. And yeah, he also recently mentioned, you know, better materials for printing cells for clinical applications. And actually, that's another interesting thing with the inks, having to do the market analysis on the axolotl side. So many of the inks have animal-derived products, so you aren't going to be printing tissues with those that go into people. And I've actually talked about that a lot with some of our collaborators, including Aspect, you know, and even with Cell Inc. We talk biomaterial sourcing, just getting things to be really consistent in these fields is a lot more difficult than, you know, you look at traditional 3D printing and you're like, plastics, so easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, well, yeah. Before I asked you that question, I had some challenges in mind, but now that you're talking, I'm learning there are more challenges than I knew about the animal-derived products. That is definitely a challenge. And also just to clarify some of the concepts that we see a lot in the news so that people have a more clear understanding of concepts is the concept of organoid. And also I also want you to also address another concept of the organ on a chip concept, the microfluidics that you just mentioned. I think these concepts are kind of mixed up with bioprinting and 3D printing a lot. And I think it would be just helpful to have an actual professor to explain that to us.
Definitely. So organoids are essentially miniature tissues that are derived from stem cells. And the principle of this is we all arose from embryos that contain these stem cells that have instructions on how to make any cell type found in your body. Organoids take this idea and essentially use those inherent properties of stem cells to generate these miniature tissues. Our lab's done them for that you can make these miniature brains and they will have neuronal function and things like that. You also see miniature kidneys. And so it really comes from this intrinsic property of stem cells that you get these organoid mini tissues. And so that's where that concept comes from. It's been a bit difficult to get these to be super reproducible, though a lot of really great engineering groups are working on it. My friend Ethan Lippman, he's at Vanderbilt, his group has done a lot of really cool work. Because when you make them, you're usually putting them in bioreactors and things like that. And anytime you work with cells, there's inherent variability, but lots of cool stuff there. Organ on a chip is, again, you know, and some people even say, like, we put organoids on a chip. And really is where you're getting in these microfluidic systems where you're miniaturizing the tissues. So you're usually, you know, looking at these devices in the microscale and you'll have, you know, some cells present. The nice thing about being in miniature is you can actually have, you know, multiple cell types present, and then you can have sort of a tissue chip that's your liver versus, you know, your kidneys and string them all together, although there are still challenges getting all your things to work in the same place. And since you did bring up microfluidics, I do have one of the Aspect microfluidic print heads, which I don't know if that'll show up on camera.
To hold it at a certain light, I think.
Yeah. Okay, let's see.
It's probably difficult.
Yeah, it's clear, so it's a bit hard to see, but actually I can probably pull it out.
So you can also take a picture later and then we'll include it in our post-process video as well.
Yeah, so essentially you have these little plastic chips that have different channels, and so you can fill them with cells. In the case of Aspect, they use it to deliver your bioink. And so you can culture them just like you would normal cells, but they're miniature, so you know, saves money because you're using less resources. And then you can, as I said, string together multiple things. So that's sort of your organoids, your microfluidics. And there is a whole subset of bioprinting, as you've seen here, where they use these microfluidic printheads to make complex tissue models.
Yeah.
In that sense. So
that's a huge subject. Microfluidic itself is a huge subject, also with a pretty interesting history as well. But going back to these two concepts, so my understanding of organoids is basically a rather disorganized clump of cells that you were able to grow with no vasculatures or any other kind of complexities. Is that true?
No, you can get some of the brain organoids can be pretty complex, and you can, in some cases, induce vasculature, which is a whole nother kettle of fish there. But definitely with some of the brain organoids, you do see the organization. The issue comes up with it's not as consistent as people would like. And that's why it's been a bit like pharmaceutical companies have been really slow to use them for drug screen applications. They look when they work, they look really cool. You can see some of the different regions of the brain. And it also depends on what factors you treat with. I haven't done a literature search lately, but usually for the brain organoids, it is the lack of vasculature that limits their size when you're actually making these tissues. Although some people have actually made multiple different brain organoid regions and then they stick them together, which is also kind of interesting. But like the vasculature issue remains challenging, I think, both for organoids and bioprinted tissues, as well as also organ on a chip, because it's hard to get your blood flow to coordinate with your tissue.
Yeah.
Trying to model stuff.
It would be hard to imagine. I think the limitation of the organ on a chip is limited in size of how much you can grow the cells in three dimension. Is that right?
Well, sort of. Because I mean, if you get over a certain size, then you aren't really going to be microfluidic. Like you lose all the advantages of being, a small microfluidic chip, if you scale up in size.
So obviously, bioprinting can address some of these challenges. Like maybe it can be more consistent, and maybe it have more, more, I would say, I'm missing out the word, like a broader ability of creating complex 3D larger structures.
Yeah, well, I think like inherently with bioprinting, and it goes to printer resolution, but since you are starting with the same file each time, it's a bit more reproducible than some of the organoid methods currently. The other area where I think Jordan Miller and his lab at Rice and also Volumetrics have done some really lovely work is with their work making vasculature and their printing technologies, where I see it all having to sort of connect, kind of like his technologies or the Prelis technologies, where you've got people working really strongly on the vasculature to keep it intact, and then being able to print tissue on top of that, which is something we've done in our lab, where we've actually printed directly neural progenitors on one of these Pirellis baskets that's mimicking vasculature. So I think we'll get there eventually, but as with all things, it's getting your technologies to integrate. Even like with the organ on a chip stuff, you might not think about it, but if you're trying to connect a brain tissue to a heart tissue to a kidney tissue and have it all be on the same circulatory system, normally in a dish, you don't have a circulatory system, you have cell culture media. And brain tissue media is way different from kidney. And so a lot of times with that, the biggest challenge in microfluidics is actually getting a media that'll grow both. And that's something that we've also seen a little bit when we've been moving into trying to do some vasculature with our brain tissues too.
Awesome. I think it will be a miss without saying that most of your research, at least in the past, has been focusing on the brain. And I actually remember how we met, Stephanie. do you remember how we met? We met at a conference maybe 4 or 5 years ago at one of those University of Victoria bioprinting conference hosted by Aspect. That was the first time I met you. You're one of the most energetic speakers among all other scientists. And we were both holding a glass of wine and you're telling me that you focus your research on the brain. You just published a book actually on the brain. And I actually, my current history still is neuroradiologist, and I did research in GBM, and I take care of GBM patients on a daily basis almost. So I totally understand the devastation of that disease and among other neurological disease. So you want to just tell us a little bit about what kind of research work you do focusing on the brain?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah. Oh my gosh. That brings back memories. Yeah. The ASPECT conference, I'm like on the patio at UBC.
Yes.
Yeah. And then in the background. Our lab and my research program has always been mainly focused around neural tissue. I started off being very hardcore spinal cord injury, which is quite interesting because in recent years we've moved definitely more into brain tissue. And so we've really been looking at ways to bioprint patient-derived human-induced pluripotent stem cell lines. So we have some HIPSC lines from our collaborator, Dr. Haka Nygaard, who's over at UBC. And also, I think he would be mad if I didn't mention this, but if anybody out there who does bioprinting with stem cells is looking for a postdoc, we are looking for someone to work on these projects I'm about to talk about. So he runs their Alzheimer's clinic. So he's an MD, PhD. So he sees patients like you do. And they actually, you can actually do a blood draw from the patients, reprogram them back into being stem cells. And we've been able to bioprint them. And my student, John Walter Shumka, who's actually defending his thesis this afternoon, he actually did bioprint these patient Alzheimer's cell lines into tissues in his whole thesis. It's lovely work. We're hoping to submit it later this summer. Showed that, you know, you do see these neuronal deficiencies in the 3D printed tissues compared to when they've been isogenically controls, these control cell lines that corrected for the Alzheimer's mutation. So it's a bit crazy that you can study Alzheimer's in a dish, and now we're studying it as 3D printed tissue. We're doing similar work with a Parkinson's line with my graduate student, Ruchi, who I think is actually speaking this Saturday at one of the local groups that is looking into 3D bioprinting as an alternative to animal testing. And then with glioblastoma, we have a collaboration with a company called Zonula, and we had a really excellent paper come out this past summer where my former student, Emka, printed this co-culture model where we had human glioblastoma alongside healthy neural tissue, and we found this drug from the company that would just selectively destroy these tumors in the 3D model, which in terms of 3D printing, and you know, as a doctor, glioblastoma was horrible
disease. Yes.
And when you culture these cells in 2D versus 3D, when we culture them in our 3D bioprinted tissues, like, they are so invasive and it's such a terrible disease. But also that's why it's been so hard to study, is you don't have models that are replicating that those properties when it's a big, tightly connected tumor. And so it's much easier to kill cancer in 2D than actually in a brain or in a 3D tissue. So I think that that's where you're going to see a lot of power in these 3D bioprinting approaches. And I know that there's lots of other groups out there that have been looking at all these different cancer models with bioprinting.
So. Yeah, I actually remember seeing that paper. I was pretty excited, and I sent it to all my neurosurgeons because, you know, it's such a hopeless thing once you get the diagnosis. But I know we're going to find a solution to this. So guys, just stay tuned for future Stephanie's work on this. So let's pivot a little bit. Now, you're a professor, but how did you decide to start a company, which is Axolotl? First of all, what is Axolotl? I have to look that up.
Yeah.
It's a small animal, but it's a mammal. It's, what is it?
The Mexican salamander. So that's, yeah, like my yeah. So they, so Laura, our co-founder, she's actually from Mexico. So this was our mascot because they have a highly regenerative nervous system. So there's a whole field of regenerative medicine where they study things like the axolotl that have high regenerative capacity, and they compare it to, you know, so why can their nervous system regenerate and humans can't? And it's sort of an evolutionary thing, which is at some point that, you know, the things that make us human, our developed brains, our spinal cords, to let us do all these, you know, like have conversations like this. It's evolutionarily better if you have a brain injury, a spinal cord injury, to actually just seal off the spare tissue rather than try to regenerate, because you can actually have some pretty devastating effects. And I mean, this is, you know, years of evolution. Whereas if you're an axolotl chilling in Mexico, swimming around in the lake, or, you know, you're a planaria, it's, you know, just regenerate all you want, because, like, what's, you know, it's such a simple organism. So that's where our mascot came from, is their highly regenerative nervous system. And
that makes sense.
So, yeah.
So what is Axolotl Biosciences does?
Yeah, so we specialize in making high quality bio inks to print essentially tissues derived from human stem cells. So as I've told you, and people who've heard this story know, and maybe people here have bothered me about this, my research lab focused on making biomaterials that were really good at supporting neural cell growth and differentiation. And we started working with Aspect, and we made a printable version. And so then a lot of groups reached out and were like, can we use your bioink to print like our tissues? So we're sending it to collaborators. And then a lot of other scientists reached out and were like, can we just buy your ink? And so that's when we decided we should incorporate. Also, Eric, who's the CEO of CellLink, we were talking at the Biomedical Engineering Society meeting. You know, it's making me sad. Think about, you know, when we used to see everybody in person. And so he was like, why aren't you selling your ink? Like, there's a market for it. And so that's where we're at. We incorporated a year ago. We've got our ink out in beta with, I think, 5 or 6 different companies and 7 or 8 academic groups. And we're hoping to launch our online platform to sell. All of our technology is now licensed from the university, and all the things are in place. So we're hoping to sell our initial product called Tissue Print BioInk starting next month. And then we also have a second line of products. So for those of you who've seen Ruchi's paper where we've printed the miniature brains with drug releasing microspheres, we're hoping to commercialize brain print. We've got some funding to take that to market as well. So we're pretty excited about it. And if you want to learn more, you're on our Instagram, so you can click to our website.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about bioink, because it's actually a very broad subject. And then sometimes people go into biomaterials, I think they're kind of interchangeable, except for ink is more of a suggestion as a fluid. I know you can't tell me exactly what goes into your ink, because it's kind of a trade secret. But like, what are some of the typical concerns for a scientist in a lab doing bioprinting in terms of choosing bioink?
Yeah, well, so it's sort of interesting, because if you look at what's commercially available, as I said, a lot of this is you know, they're pretty much, most bioinks are usually either naturally derived, or you do see a lot of like gelma based bioinks. Collagen's really popular. Ours is fibrin based, so it's the blood protein. And so a lot of these inks were initially chosen because you could actually get them to print with a printer. So either physically cross-linked enzymatically or through other elements like ions, or there's also a lot of the gelma ones are UV cross-linkable. So, you know, you have to have some way to, you know, turn your bioink into a solid. And so I think for a lot of the initial ink development, it was done based on what can we actually print and get the resolution we want, as opposed to actually getting tissue function. And this is something you actually see a lot, even still with microfluidics, where, you know, they'll put some neuronal cells on a chip and they'll grow them for 3 days and they'll be like, hey, neuron on a chip. But it's not really, you know, that's not really long-term cell survival and things like that.
Yeah.
The other thing is you see, and a lot of these inks were just used to print some of the easiest cells to print. So, you know, print some cancer cells, they're pretty indifferent to their environment. But if you print things like stem cells, they're very sensitive. So that's where another reason we started the company is a lot of people who are printing stems would try to print stem cells, they would all die. And then they would ask us, you know, how do you get your cells to survive? And also, the other thing is, you know, if you actually want to take this out as a technology for drug screening, you have to have a functional output that you can measure. So, you know, with our Alzheimer's cells, you know, we look at the differentiation of the neurons, the length, and then you can also actually measure, you know, the amounts of tau and the amyloid beta in the media. So that's what you really want to see is, you know, are these neurons, you know, are they electrically functioning? Are they secreting the right factors and things like that? Because you, at the end of the day, you'll need an impact and output to measure if you're going to say, did this drug have an effect?
Yeah, I think, you know, in 3D printing industry in general, we're very attracted to the structure part of 3D printing, because just visually it's very appealing. But I think now more and more so people will start to pay attention at the functional components of it. So I would imagine that for your ink or whatever future ink you make, that you have a set of metrics you're looking at, which you already talked a little bit about cell viability. If they're secreting the right kind of chemicals or signals, genetic expression, I would imagine.
Yep.
What else are you looking at in terms of like optimal outcome of a bioink?
Yeah. I mean, like you also, there's all the physical properties like your rheology, and consistency, pore size for some of the hydrogel based bioinks. As you mentioned, cell viability, cell, expression profiling. When you commercialize things, you know, there's all the stability testing, making sure, you know, you're contamination free if you're shipping things out like that. So yeah. It's a pretty standard panel of things. And there have been, I know Matt Kinsella's group over at McGill has done some really nice work towards coming up with these like parameters to quantify bioinks, because they do tend to be, in terms of mechanical properties, tend to be less stiff than things like plastics and sort of printability. And then there's the whole field of, you know, the sheer thinning hydrogels that, you know, you use to print that then come back and take their shape. So I think there's still, you know, a bit of rigor to be added to the field. But as I mentioned, it's so highly interdisciplinary. It's been interesting to see, like, you know, that like you can put out really nice bioprinting papers and still have 1,000 questions about the properties of the ink, the properties of the structure. That's one thing that, sorry, this one's going on a little tangent, but like Conrad from Aspect and I, along with Simon from Aspect, we did a review paper on bioprinting brain tissue, and it blew my mind how many people just printed grids for neural tissue. And you're like, well, you don't really see a grid in the body, but if you do print a grid, everyone knows you bioprinted it. So right. I think there's still a lot of work to be done just in terms of, you know, advancing these structures now that we have the technology to do what you want to do, just because it's so interdisciplinary. So
the ink that Axolotl produces obviously is a consumable. Is this available to all kinds of printing technology, or is it only extrusion right now?
Yeah, it's a chemically cross-linked version. So yeah, you need to probably have an extrusion. We're hoping to eventually look into some of the other methods. I know Jordan's really on us to look at, you know, finding printable versions for the Luminex too. Yeah, so these are just, you know, this is some of the stuff we've been working on for a really long time. So we've got it pretty much ready to go. But it'll be really interesting to see, you know, where the field goes and where we can take the technology.
So from your perspective, who are the dominant players, either people, labs, or companies?
Yeah, well, one of the companies who's been really exciting to watch them grow has been Cellink, and sort of how they've transformed from a bioink company into, I think they're taking over the world.
Yeah, kind of, yes.
Yeah. Acquiring everybody, and they actually they just launched their clinical grade printer. I think it's the PDX. So that's pretty, like, it's been really interesting, sort of the companies they've acquired and what they're doing with their technology. Obviously here in Canada, got to give a shout out to Aspect. They're doing some really interesting things with getting their technology used for actually making tissues you put into people. Alevi Volumetrics and Jordan Miller, great. I think we talked about Dimension Inks, which I think is really cool out of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Fluid Form, I think, is doing some really cool things. Regen Matt 3D and Brinter. Like, there's actually, I think it's always interesting to see the different, you know, technologies from the different companies, especially from Europe. And then there's also been some really cool work out of Korea. But yeah, I know that they're more focused on things that are not necessarily health related, but Carbon 3D and Joe DeSimone's group, like, just really cool technology. Although I know they've been more focused on making things like shoes recently than
bikes. Yeah, actually, one major player I think that started to show up in the news is 3D Systems, started to do all kinds of stuff with bioprinting. Desktop Meadow.
Oh, yeah.
Just acquired Envision Tech, Everybody is definitely looking into growing the 3D bioprinting space. So you're lucky, Stephanie. This is a great timing to start a company. So we talked a little bit about future game changers, a little bit in the space. What do you think are going to be the future game changers for bioprinting? And maybe some of them are on your wish list of you wish you have that already.
Yeah, one of the things that comes up a lot, especially if you're going to print tissues like we do in our lab, is we need better ways of generating large numbers of cells, because you just need a lot of cells to print humanized tissues, and even our organs have really high cell densities. So especially for stem cells, scale up of cell production will be key. I think one thing we've talked about is like going to be the separation of clinical adoption of 3D printing versus the research adoption. Because I really think that that's sort of two different markets. And I think you're really going to see at hospitals, like clinical core facilities, where doctors will just biopsy the patient, get them reprogrammed, and then, you know, the facility will do the printing and characterization and drug screening. Because I really think, just given what Dr. Nygaard and I've seen and his iPSC lines from his patients with both Alzheimer's and dementia, like, I think a lot of these diseases are a lot more heterogeneous than we thought. So I really think there's going to be a big trend towards personalized medicine. The other thing will be that I'm pretty optimistic about is getting these into the pipeline for clinical drug development. So we all know that animal testing isn't great. It's what we do because that's what we had. But now that we actually can generate human tissues from stem cells as opposed to having to rely on donations, I think that'll be really big, is when we start getting these approved tissue models that you can use to at least start to not eliminate, but at least cut down on the number of animal testing and even being used in combination, because I think you'll see a lot of different effects, which is why, you know, a lot of drugs fail when they go to clinic, is because animals don't actively predict it. So I think you'll see that I think will be a big game changer too. So,
well, just to give people a concept of how many cells you're talking about, how many cells in a, maybe 1 centimeter of tissue that you can bioprint?
We usually print between like 1 to 5 million cells per mil, because we suspended in mils of BioInk. I know Adam's group, I think, is going up to like in the hundreds of millions. So you're really looking at tons and tons of cells for those of you who haven't done cell culture. And usually it's all done essentially as manual labor by grad students. We really need some advances in bioreactor technology to get that going up. So.
Yeah, that's a lot of cells. I have a couple of shout outs, and one is from Shweta, Snatty Scientist is her handle. It says, great work. It would be interesting working. I just interviewed her a couple of weeks ago. She does bioprinting electronics wearables.
Oh, nice.
So that could be very interesting. She's looking into collaborating electrical stimulation on neural cells.
Nice. Yeah.
That's
definitely big.
Let's see. Well, there are some happiness and some on fire means. So anyways, let's see. I think we addressed a lot of topics today. Just want to make sure I'm not missing any topics here. How is COVID in Canada? I mean, are you guys fully functional? Labs totally open?
No, yeah, we're unlimited, and then we're getting our third wave now. So it's, the numbers, like, I think, yeah, let's just keep going up by the day, because we just had spring break and then the testing lags 2 weeks. We're under COVID protocols. So it's, you know, social distance in lab, 4 people in lab at a time, but we've still been managing to be somewhat productive despite limitations. Also not helped by, and shout out to anybody from my lab watching, not helped by the fact, or maybe helped by the fact that there's nowhere fun to go since travel's not really allowed. So I feel like a bad boss when I try to be like, well, maybe you should go. And I'm like, oh yeah.
Study. Yeah.
Well, that's why they're at work, because they're like, well, what else is there to do if, you know, restaurants are closed and everything's closed. So
yeah, but I'm sure it's going to pass, and our time is up. And thank you everyone for joining us. Stephanie, do you have any final shout outs to names? Feel free to say that right now.
I don't know who else here, but thanks everybody for coming, and definitely check out my lab, the Willard Lab, in Axolotl. And yeah, and thanks, Jenny. Yeah, and 3D Heals has been great. And, you know, I remember we had lots of great 3D Heals events before.
Yes. Before. Thank you very much for always engaging with us. I will include all the links of your labs, of your publications, and even give a shout out of the postdoc that you're trying to promote on our website and also social media. Thank you very much, Stephanie.
All right.
And bye, everybody.
That's it for this episode.
Bye, everybody.
Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at 3D Heals, and check out the links in the show notes. See you next time.